So who's here? Well, it's great to be on retreat. I've canceled most of my teaching engagements recently. This is the only one I've undertaken because my mom's 90 now, as most of you know, and her health is so-so. And so I've wanted to stay near Ottawa. But I certainly miss these occasions, so it's good that you all turned up, because I couldn't do this if you didn't. And I don't know if you know the bhikkhus who are here with me. Ajahn Kusala, he's recently been living in the community near Thunder Bay, Arrow River. And Venerable Pavaro, who's come all the way from Birken, Kelowna, Kamloops. And people have come from all over the place, so it's good to be here. Can you hear me in the back? Ash, you okay? Dave, yeah? Apologies for the shortage of chanting books. We'll get a Xerox copy tomorrow, probably. It's a Xerox machine here. We'll copy out some pages. To come here, for all of you, I think, is to take quite a lot of effort. It has for me, to organize your life in a way where you can get 9 days away from your responsibilities, away from your families, away from your work, etc. Takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of what we call good karma, I think. And if you assemble all that together for 40 of us, having this opportunity to practice together, that's a lot of goodness. So I always feel to start a retreat to start with gratitude rather than do it on the ninth day when we have the big sharing, because gratitude is a state of heart which must be very close to enlightenment, because you don't want anything, and if enlightenment is beyond desire, so why not start with enlightenment? Want to be grateful, and to remember that the goodness that we are involved in, even though our minds will throw up some pretty naughty things, and I need some naughty things. So even though the experience of meditation, for most of us, it's not easy. Restlessness and the change of environment, and too hot or too cold or too crowded, and so there's a lot of things that we're working on. But what underlies that is this. This beautiful aspiration in all of us to be better people, to be more peaceful people, to be more loving people, if you want to go for the big one, to be enlightened, in whatever way we phrase that. And this is to keep that in mind, to keep that underlying intention, that the beauty of the heart searching for truth, no matter what the mind is throwing up. So if you feel angry at someone, that's fine, but that's not, you don't want that, it's just the way it is. So the underlying attitude is deeper than the superficial comings and goings of our thoughts and all of that. The teaching, as most of you know, is set out in various ways. One of the ways it's set out, it's in a twofold manner. One is the social teaching, and one is the teaching about the mind and consciousness. So the social teaching is about ethics, it's about our responsibilities, it's about relationships, it's about the way we live in the world as individuals, as personalities, as members of family, in the workplace, in the monastery, wherever. And a monastery in a retreat, or this is like we create a monastery, and we create a social structure which simplifies that one aspect of the Dhamma. We make it very, very clear, very, very simple, so that we can work on that other aspect of Dhamma, is the mind, the heart. So in the first aspect, we create a structure which is based on, to some extent, based on the ashram monastic structures from India, where we simplify everything, where we agree upon a certain schedule, certain codes of behavior, We practice noble silence, and all that need to be a person in society is kind of streamlined. You can't live life like this all the time. We don't practice noble silence in the monastery. We have to talk, we have to relate. But this kind of situation is very special, but it's not real life. So the structures that we live by give us a chance to look at consciousness in an impersonal way. We can, whatever we're feeling and experiencing in this retreat, we try to observe it in an impersonal way. Whether we're happy, we're sad, whether we're lonely, whether we're feeling like we're getting somewhere, whether or not feel like we're getting nowhere. We try to watch all that as movement, as consciousness, and understand it in a kind of, in a dharmic way, rather than just be caught up in the personality view. And I'll talk about that. So to establish this social relationship, which we're going to live by, most of you know what we do is we pay homage to the Buddha, we take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and we take the eight precepts. And that's a convention which those of you who have done retreats are familiar with. But realize, well, what is it for? It's first of all, it's a common agreement, because we're going to practice as community, not just some vague community where we all live in our own apartment and have our own newspapers and types of coffee, but we're actually going to be in community, residential community, living in community. So, and it's a pretty tight space. Notice we had to actually really regulate the space with all these little bits of masking tape, otherwise couldn't fit anyone in. So it's quite tight. It's quite a tight space. And we'll be moving around and so on and so forth. So to remember, we are in community. We're trying to help each other in this work. So that the sense of compassion, of sharing the space, of being sensitive to this space, this whole place, that's very important. And yet, because we're practicing noble silence, and we're not relating the usual social levels, talking about what work we do and all that, it's also very individual. So it's an interesting combination of being in a living community, but also being very much with yourself. It's kind of an interesting combination. So if you're not used to doing a 10-day retreat, it's weird. You walk around, should I look in someone's eyes or shouldn't I? You're sitting at a table with four people, you know, kind of no one's talking. So just hang in with the weirdness and just let it be the way it is. And it gives your mind a chance to settle, because on a retreat, you don't have to be the usual personality that you are. You will be. It'll come up. But you don't have to explain yourself. You don't have to be popular. You don't have to say how much you earn or what kind of a car you drive, or you don't have to do all that. So you have this kind of freedom to be with whatever moods are coming up into consciousness, whatever states of mind come, you just be with that. And yet also be sensitive to the other people. That's a very important part of the retreat. So we try to cultivate a communal sensitivity and yet really pay attention to our hearts and minds in a very individual way. So that's the raison d'etre of the structure. So what we usually do is we begin by, and we have this in the chanting books. For those of you who don't have, can you just share it for this evening? And let's just look at the traditional structure for those of you who aren't familiar with it. So I'm looking for the eight precepts, if anyone finds it. What page? 75. Let's have a look. 75. Try with, let's do 72 first. So for, again, for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, this particular tradition, these forms that we use, they're not a necessary part of a Buddhist practice, right? So don't feel that you have to do this. But they've been developed as a kind of a communal response of people trying to travel with the same kind of vehicle for many, many, many centuries, and try to do it in a kind of communal way where there's a liturgy, there's ritual, there's art. All of that is a part of Buddhism, of a religious tradition. And so what we're trying to do is employ those things like chanting and kind of communal doing of things, so that we're kind of feeling this as a group, as we're doing it together. And the first thing we always do in any Buddhist practice, on page 72 there, is we pay homage to the Buddha. So if you consider what that means, even if you don't even know if the Buddha lived, say, right? So you kind of, well, I don't know. You're kind of in, what would you call that, sort of a really kind of critical historical attitude to life. You know, I don't know if you really lived. What it points to is not so much to a personality or to a even history. It's the sense of both gratitude, homage, and also hope. Because to me, what a Buddha implies, or any enlightened being, or enlightenment itself, implies tremendous optimism. You know, that we as human beings do have this beautiful potential. You know, it doesn't have to be a rock. We have this fantastic possibility of deep compassion and deep wisdom, and the enlightenment of the Buddha represents that. So it the homage to the Buddha then, for me, is a statement of devotion, of gratitude, and of optimism. And if you are not sort of really embedded in a real strong Buddhist practice, that's fine. But do you have ways that you can use ritual or art or mantra or chanting that bring forth those very wholesome mind states? It's a very wholesome thing to feel gratitude. It's a very wholesome thing to feel there is a path, there is a spiritual life, there is a doing of this, right? And that's the way I like to use it. So I always like to begin the meditation doing this little bit of chanting that we do. And so in the ritual that we undertake, a lay person, maybe Stephen, you'll be able to do that, huh? To ask for the refuges and precepts. A lay person makes a request, and then the teachers offer that back as he's doing his homework. So I would chant Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. You see on 72? And I would chant that three times, and then you could chant that three times in response. So there's a statement and a response, right? And so what it's doing psychologically, or in consciousness, is bringing forth the sense of aspiration, the sense of devotion, of gratitude, of optimism. That's the way I use it. And then the next part there, you see, Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Now if you go to the top of the very first line, you see, after bowing three times, right at the top there, where it says, Mayang Bhante Tissaranena. You see that word, Tissaranena? Well, the name of the monastery which we are going to build in the Lanark Perth area is Tissarana. You like that? The better. You have no choice. Tissarana. And Tissarana means three refuges. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. So, more significant. So if we go down the page, then below the homage to the Buddha, we have Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, Dhammang Saranam Gacchami, Sanghang Saranam Gacchami. So Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, they're known as the three refuges. And again, most of you know this, but just for those who are new to the tradition. So in this case, Buddha is used as the mind which is awake. So Buddha is used in the way I've learned it from Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah and other teachers, is there's Buddha as that, the being of enlightenment, but there also is that the root of the word is awake. So when I take refuge in Buddha, I'm remembering to be awake. I'm remembering to be here now. This is the way it is, right? So that's a kind of more like an existential way of using the word Buddha. Awake. Wake up. That kind of word. So it's a very powerful word, Buddha. So when I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in knowing, in being present. Huh? Then Dharma is teachings. So that's the intellectual teachings and all what you hear in tapes and talks and all of that, the readings that we do. But also then as a realized truth, right, as a realized truth, it's also very existential in the sense of when I really have some insight about life, when I really understand life, that's Dharma. Not just an opinion, not just a Buddhist opinion, but when I've really connected that when I act in this way, that leads to my happiness and the happiness of others. And when I act in that the other way, it leads to confusion. And I know that. And I'm not going to go to confusion. I'm going to go to peace. And when I know that really clearly, that's Dharma, isn't it? It's not book learning. It's not an opinion. It's the way I live my life. And so the teachings are encouraging us to be very reflective and use them to understand ourselves until we see like the Buddha sees. Our seeing is as clear as the Buddha's is, and that's Dharma. And that's something that gains in depth and profundity as we practice, as we live our lives. And then Sangha. Sangha is community of practitioners. So you could say it's all of us, community. But deeper than that, it's what community does. What does the spiritual community live by? Like the word Sangha is used a lot now. So I would ask those people who use the word Sangha, do you keep the five precepts? Is that part of Sangha? Because a word like Sangha can be used so loosely now, it can mean anything. But what's the commitment? What does Sangha do? Sangha lives by precepts. It lives ethically. It contemplates Dhamma. It's a life of responsibility. It's a life of altruism. It's a life of compassion. So it's what a spiritual community would actually do, or what a spiritual individual would actually be doing. And that's an inner refuge. No matter what the larger community is doing, if everyone is doing something which is inappropriate, that's not Sangha, even though they might call themselves Sangha. That's not Sangha. Sangha is really living the life, really doing the work in an inappropriate way. So when we take refuge in Sangha, it can't really be something external. Right? We can help each other to some extent. We can hassle each other too, and you know, we've all seen that in communities where, you know, you get a really nice Buddhist community having difficulties and arguments and all of that, and that's just the nature of human society. But the real refuge, I think, is like this the Sangha in your heart is the work you have to do, the commitment one has to make, the aspiration one is involved in. That is truly a refuge, and we all have a sensibility around that. So Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Tisarana, good monastery, good name. Buddha is both the teacher and the awake mind. The Dharma is both the teaching and your own realization of that. Sangha is the community and the work that the community does as individuals. So that the formulation of that is I would chant Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, and then you would chant it, and I would chant it. There's a kind of statement and a response. And then dutiyampi means the second time. Tatiyampi, if you flip over to 73, a third time. So we do that in threes, three times. And then you see, I would say, if you're with me on 73, just above the five precepts, the leader says, tissarana gamanang nititang, I'd say that. And then you would respond with amapante. And it is a ritual, and so if you say Hemanta's from Sri Lanka, she's been doing this all her life, once you evolve this ritual, then it touches you. Imagine if you've done something which is spiritually significant. You've had a ritual which is spiritually significant, you've done it for 50 years. And you've done it significantly, not as a parrot. And you've done it with heart. And each time you touch that, it evokes all that kind of spiritual aspiration in your heart. That's the beauty of ritual when it's done well. When it's done poorly, it's superstitious or, you know, whatever, but it can be done well. And so that's the idea of creating a ritual which has structure in it. So if I could look at the five precepts with you. I haven't spoken for a long time, so far. So the five precepts. Eight, better, yeah, holy, you're not present. Thank you, sir. I'm going to have a party tonight. save my bacon there. 75. Oh, thank you. Page 75. So as my venerable friend said, blame him. The eight precepts, we have eight precepts and five precepts, as you all know. Eight precepts is more what we do on a retreat or a monastery. So if we could go through those, the first one, I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. So the precept is one if the impulse to kill a fly, say, or a spider or something like that, the impulse comes up, that's natural, that's a part of your makeup. You're afraid of spiders, you want to kill it, okay, that's fine, don't do it. Easy. So it's not saying that you don't have impulses of harm, because that would then life would be impossible. We do have, you know, we have impulses. But as much as possible, not to harm any living creature. And of course, there are lots of issues about moral ambiguity and so on. If you have a larder full of mice and you've got children, you know, so there's all kinds of, sometimes it's not so straightforward, but on a retreat it is. And then when moral ambiguities come up, then you have to deal with them. But if you have this guideline, you're going to be very, very, very careful of harming any sentient creature. And what that's doing then is that whole impulse that when I don't like something, I wipe it out. That whole impulse you begin to really see that and say, no, I'm not going there. And of course, there's opposite in impulse of compassion, of caring, of sensitivity to all life. You strengthen that. So it's a beautiful way to actually develop the heart. But to accept the fact that it's okay to have harmful impulses, because they're not, it's just life, it's not a problem, right? But there is a boundary. So this is what Sangha does. Sangha practice creates boundaries around impulses which are unskillful or unwholesome. Adinadana, I undertake the precept to refrain from lozenges. No. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. So, in here, it would be kitchen. Sort of. It would be the kitchen. You wouldn't, you know, if you want to have a sandwich after this meeting, great, you can want to, but you don't do it because you're stealing. Right? It's not your kitchen. It's not our kitchen. It's the Galilee kitchen, and they give us the food, right? So, but remember, it's okay to want that, and you probably will, because you probably had dinner, I mean, tomorrow. And so what that gives you, it gives you an opportunity to see what does it feel like to not have what you want. And you make it through to the next day. But to actually, you know, to have an impulse of wanting to take something maybe, and just watch it, no problem. Obviously, at a more gross level, if we were nicking each other's clocks or whatever, we wouldn't make it on time for the meditation. But also, we'd be paranoid. So obviously, but that's not a problem in a group like this. But just a sense of impeccability. So in a larger moral context, it would be like copyright, right? Honoring copyright. Well, but Sony makes lots of money. I can just copy 20 CDs and no, copyright is stealing, right? If I break copyright. So it's a very high standard in Buddhism. Those are things you have to decide after the retreat. But the impulse of taking that not which is not given, we protect the mind from going that way because it doesn't bring joy, it doesn't bring honor. A brahmacharya varamani sikapadang samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from any kind of sexual activity, so we practice celibacy. And that is a precept which is an ashram precept or a monastery precept. It's not a lay precept. In the five precepts, it's to practice fidelity, proper sexuality in relationships. So there's nothing wrong with sexual impulses. They are natural. And when they become conscious on a retreat, we try not to pursue them. Obviously physically, but also just the kind of the way the mind likes to entertain itself with that. We don't go there. So it's a precept which really simplifies life. But it's not to be seen as repression. It's not to be seen as something wrong with sexuality. It's natural. So it's to understand sexuality in a celibate context. You can do that. You can understand sexual energy as a celibate or non-celibate, because it's still energy. It still can be understood. One could repress it, which will make you crazy. That won't work. But celibacy does not mean repression. It means restraint, and then observing what that energy is like and understanding. It's a learning about sexuality in celibacy. Interesting one, huh? Musawada, I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech. So in the context of the retreat, noble silence, which is, again, it's not normal to do that, so you feel a bit odd, and bear with that, but it's so important for being really with yourself and keeping the tone of the retreat composed. It's very helpful. You imagine if we were just chatting all the time, it'd be a whole different scene. It is a chance to go inwards. You know, it's a chance for you to have your time with your heart. You don't have to be a personality. And obviously, for those who are very gregarious, it's harder than for those who are naturally more kind of inward. So it's a harder discipline. But that's all right. That's something to observe and watch. So noble silence. It's like. To observe the impulse to want to talk, right? Which is a feeling of wanting to talk, and then putting a boundary on that, not talking. Obviously, if there's a need for some kind of organizational things, you can ask Arsalan. If you have any Dhamma questions, you can ask me. In terms of questions, I think maybe we'll put out some paper and pens out back, and I prefer written questions, because I found in the past that if I put questions to the floor, it gets into a lot of dialogue, and the mind gets quite busy with thinking about how to answer that question, and I like to keep it more quiet. So if you have any questions that come up, if you want to ask me personally, then if you seek out Arsalan, I can arrange an interview. There'll be interviews later too. But otherwise, if you have a question that you think I could answer without a personal interview, if you just write it down and leave it here, and that's helpful for me with feedback too. Okay. Noble silence. And the fifth precept, I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness. So alcohol and grass and things like that. Or if you have any medications that you're taking from the doctor's prescription, that's fine. So we're just working with the sober, straight mind rather than creating alternative consciousness with psychedelics or just trying to block the mind out with alcohol. Vikala bhojana, I undertake the precept to refrain from eating at inappropriate times. And this is not a moral precept, this is a renouncing precept, it's a simplification precept. And so the food situation is as it is, and those are the times that we can partake of food. And then if some people have issues with hypoglycemia, they've talked with Arsalan, we try to accommodate that. But in general, then those are the times you eat, enjoy it, and the other times you don't. So it's very, very simple. Hopefully you want to eat when we eat. Because if you want to eat when we don't eat, you're in trouble. So if you start to crave for food, you start to fantasize about it. People do that. To just see that, it's just a craving for food, wanting food. And people use food in all kinds of ways, don't they? Use it for distraction, use it in all kinds of ways. Well, now we don't have that avenue. So what we're doing with the eight precepts is we are limiting the avenues of sense stimulation. Right? We're not saying it's wrong. We're not saying it's wrong to eat. It's not a moral precept. It's really the amount of the avenues of sense distraction are being really, really cut down now. So you're left with basically your mind, a few meals a day, nature. You're left with a very, very simple program, which is very helpful, because if you can just bear with the initial restlessness of not having the usual sensual distractions, such as maybe emails or books or telephone or food, you have to bear with the initial restlessness, because it's hard, because we're used to doing things, we're active people. But if you just trust in this, well, just bear witness to the wanting, and then the mind settles, because it's not going out all the time. It's not going out at the emails and work and organizing and doing this and this and that. That's the habit of the mind. We want to stay home, right? Just stay home. It's nice to find home. Very nice. Nacha Gita, I undertake the precept to refrain from entertainment, beautification, and adornment. Again, this is not a moral precept, it's simply a renunciant precept. So entertainment, music or television or DVDs or videos, I would even suggest that you don't read a lot. Best even not to read. Because reading for many of us is just entertainment. Not that it's, you know, reading can be very, very good dharma too, but just to create a challenge to yourself of not having that avenue. It's a very interesting one to watch. And just feeling the restlessness of wanting to read. I don't want to, you know, it's not like a police state where you can't, but just see what the challenge could be, or that if I'm always used to reading and I feel bored or have a doubt, I think it's much better to look at the boredom. It's much better to look at the doubt and get to know the doubt and the boredom, rather than always go to a book. And I'll speak about that. And then the thing about beautification and adornment, we don't need to do that now. People need to do that for work and so on, but we don't need to do that. So just with whatever nature is presenting, take a shower. Uchasena mahasena, I undertake the precept to refrain. That's a weird one, isn't it? From lying on a high and luxurious sleeping place. Where does that come from? That comes from India. That comes from a time when beds were luxurious. And the whole ethos there is that if we just sleep around a lot, if we're just sleeping in bed all the time, we get lazy, our minds get dull, we get depressed. So we have a very, you know, we have a quite a tight schedule, 5:30, that's quite tight. So try to get up in the morning, try to participate in the retreat. But having said that, oftentimes people come to these retreats, they're just so wiped out, you know, they're just so busy and really exhausted. If you are really exhausted, just get a lot of sleep. That's fine. That's natural. Then you'll sit better. But just the kind of using sleep as annihilation or running away, you don't want to do that. So the schedule is pretty full. Okay, that is the 8 precepts. Mm-hmm. Any questions around those before we do this formally now? We have a kind of formal ritual that we do it. All right.